بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the first part, I tried to briefly go over the concept of ijtihad, what it actually means, what needs to be studied for a person to be considered a mujtahid. And we gave a couple of examples, starting with a simple one, and a more difficult one afterwards, or two more difficult ones, to just give an impression of what ijtihad entails. Okay. Now, if you remember, the topics that we're supposed to cover today are taqlid and marja'iyya. Okay. This was the ijtihad part of it. In regards to marja'iyya, okay, there are things that are related to the other dimensions of marja'iyya. Okay. Because marja'iyya, one dimension of it is ifta', is answering questions in regards to practical laws. Okay. That is what we are addressing today. Is there any other dimension to that? Is there any other responsibility? Is there any other activity that is related to marja'iyya? Should it be there? Should it not be there? To an extent, inshallah, we'll try to discuss that tomorrow. But we're talking about the aspect of it that deals with taqlid. Okay. Now, all of what we explained, I'm trying to give the impression to people to make them realize that coming up with what our practical laws are is not an easy task. Okay. Coming up with what we need to do in regards to our prayers, in regards to our fasting, what the timings are, what do we do if we make a mistake there? What do we do if we find out later on there's najasa, for example? What do we do if the timing was slightly off? What do we do with a lot of these other things that happen? Okay, certain circumstances that we're put into. In regards to fasting, when the beginning of the month is, for example, when the end of the month is, all of these issues, okay. Now, I don't think I need to emphasize to people the idea that we do need to practice, okay, because that's a prerequisite of what I'm about to explain, okay. I think everybody is clear on we have responsibilities towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay. Nobody has any doubt regarding that. It's very important that Ahlul Bayt spend their lives not just talking about wilayah of the Ahlul Bayt or Tawheed and Ma'ad and all of that. When you look at the collections of hadith that we have, much of it, if not most of it, is about the practices that we have in our religion. Okay. It's very important. The details are very important. Sometimes we don't really pay too much attention to those details. Okay. We need to make sure we do that. We need to practice all of it. Okay. It's surprising to me to see people that consider themselves religious and others also consider them religious, but when it comes to certain areas, especially the example that comes to my mind right now, The discussions in relation to khums. I remember someone, after a long time, let me know that they weren't really familiar with khums, they weren't paying khums, and I was kind of caught by surprise. You know, this is a religious brother. What are the non-religious people doing in that case? Okay, all of the practices with all the details, okay, are important for us to learn and to implement them in our lives. Okay, now, I'm not going to explain that any further. We could go on, bring the ahadith, but because the assumption is we already understand the importance of that, okay. Once we understand that, okay, we have these responsibilities, we want to go and learn them. We want to go find out what are the things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made wajib upon us. What are the things that He has made haram upon us? Okay, what are the details to that? One way is to go and do ijtihad. Okay. Now, with what I explained, I think it should be very clear that a lot of people cannot do ijtihad. Well, even if they wanted to do ijtihad, they can't do it currently. They have to go and study, spend the many years that are necessary, and arrive at the level of ijtihad, inshallah, learn those directly from the ahadith. But for the most part, the majority of the Shia people are not going to be able to do that. That's where the concept of taqlid comes into the picture. I think the example, the explanation of taqlid that we gave is pretty simple. The definition isn't anything complicated. Basically, applying the rulings, following the laws that a faqih, a mujtahid, has come up with, their understanding, we implement that. That is called taqlid. There's a lot of details to the practical laws of that. What are all the qualities other than ijtihad? What are the qualities? Is alamiyah necessary? Is it not necessary? In what cases it is necessary for us to look for the a'lam, and so on and so forth. All these discussions are there. I'm not going to get into that. In the time that we have, because of the doubts and the questions that are raised with the concept of taqlid, okay, I want to go over the reasonings that have been mentioned in regards to the allowance of taqlid, that we are allowed to do taqlid. Because as I said, the reason why we talk about it being allowed, sometimes it's mentioned as it's wajib to do taqlid. Okay, we hear this. It's wajib for you to do taqlid if you're not doing ijtihad. What that basically means is this, that we need to know our practical laws. Okay, if you want to be a mujtahid, go ahead. But if you don't, and or you can't, or you're not right now, then you need to do taqlid. Otherwise, you're not going to know what your practical laws are. If you end up committing sins, if you end up going against the divine law, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has mandated upon us, because we didn't go and learn from the fatawa of a mujtahid, then we're going to be responsible for that. That's what that means. That's what taqlid being wajib means. Where do we come up with this? When did this start? What's the history behind it? Do we have anything opposing it? Do we, you know, let me put it this way. Why do we even need to talk about it? Sometimes, you know, you hear all these controversies, before you hear all the doubts that are raised, it's pretty straightforward, it's pretty simple, pretty easy to understand. Okay, I'm not an expert, I go and refer to the expert. Okay. However, a lot of doubts have been raised in regards to the concept of taqlid. Okay, and following a mujtahid, someone who's gone through the process of deriving the practical laws. It even became, during a period of time in our history, the concept of taqlid was condemned by our Shia ulama. We have this in our history. Because of that material, because of the books that we have available from them, because that ideology, that mentality that existed, that trend of thought remained amongst the Shia. Currently, it's being, in a way, it's being brought forth again, and people are talking about it. People are bringing up that ideology, bringing the reasonings for it. And what happens this time, because the people that do this, in this case, are not ulama, they're not mujtahideen themselves, they're not people that are very well versed with the ahadith and the verses of the Holy Quran. The discussions that you find with them are not as accurate. A lot of things are thrown around that are not correct. The likes of, for example, saying Shaykh al-Saduq is akhbari. Okay. They say Shaykh al-Saduq is one of the akhbaris. Okay, that's the biggest baloney I've heard of in my life. Okay. Shaykh al-Saduq being akhbari. There was no akhbarism during the time of Shaykh al-Saduq. Akhbarism existed during the 10th and 11th century. It only went on for about 100 years. And after that, it was basically extinct. After Wahid al-Bihbahani, we didn't have something called akhbarism. Okay. And before the akhbari movement during the Safavid dynasty, there was no such a thing called akhbarism. Amin al-Astarabadi started it, and it was finished with Shaykh Yusuf al-Bahrani, he was the last one of the Akhbaris. Before that, there wasn't any. Afterwards, there aren't any. So it's just funny to hear that. But anyway, you hear a lot of that going on, people going back and forth, and it's a growing trend. Of course, I don't know how much of a trend it is amongst the community here, but in some of the Indo-Pak community especially, you see this type of mentality and this thought growing. And of course, some of those who consider themselves intellectuals are arguing for it, and some against it online as well, which is, that's a whole different community. Anyhow, we have this this idea, this view amongst the Shia ulama that existed, started with Amin al-Astarabadi, that condemned the concept of taqlid. Okay. Some of the things that you hear that, to an extent, it makes, I don't want to say it makes sense, but you know, it sounds good at the beginning when you hear it. For example, and this concept that I'm about to mention is important for us to understand for tomorrow's discussion as well. You hear very similar statements in regards to both topics. How can you follow a person that is not ma'sum? This is one of the ideas that is put forth. Okay. How are we supposed to, and according to what the mujtahideen and the usulis say, you're supposed to follow a mujtahid. You're supposed to follow, let's say, in this time, Ayatollah Khamenei, Ayatollah Sistani, some of the other maraja that are alive, Ayatollah Makarim Shiraz, and the others that are around. We're supposed to follow them. How can you say that? These people are fallible. They're not infallible. They make mistakes. Okay. So you're telling me I have got to follow that? How can that be? And they provide evidence. Now this particular individual, he actually does that. What we said some of the people do right now, and say Shaykh As-Sadugh is Akhbari, it's probably because of their misunderstanding of what Amin al-Astarabadi is saying. Amin al-Astarabadi says, look at Shaykh As-Sadugh. He says, oh, this whole problem is because of Allama Halli, it's because of the ulama that came afterwards. They brought this usul, they started calling a hadith da'if, they started calling some of them, classifying hadith da'if, hasan, all of that. You know, what is this? All of the ahadith are acceptable. You can't reject any of the ahadith that's coming from the Sunni, so on and so forth. All those discussions. He says, look at the likes of Shaykh Saduq, these original ulama, they are actually the ulama. Look at their books of fatwa, if we can call them, and they present us with hadith. Okay. So because of this, we need to kind of go over the reasoning, the explanation behind this concept of taqlid. Where do we get it from? Is there a history behind it? Did it exist during the time of the Ahlul Bayt? Have the Ahlul Bayt said anything in regards to it? Of course, we're not shying away from, we're not trying to use this idea that if we really come to the conclusion, if we do, it's a difficult one, but if we come to the conclusion that taqlid is not allowed, okay, then the result is all of you have got to leave what you have to do here and go and learn, become mujtahid for yourself, okay, and learn how to derive the practical laws yourself, okay. We're not shying away from that either. But let's see, do we have any proof? Do we have anything from the Ahlul Bayt pro or against it, promoting it or going against it? When you look at the books of fiqh, the fiqh books that we have from the ulama, the strongest reasoning that is mentioned at the beginning, which these neo-akhbaris may not understand, okay, the strongest proof is Siratul Uqala, they call it. Alright, recite the salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Siratul Uqala, the strongest proof that we have for taqlid being allowed is Siratul Uqala. They've mentioned this first. What is Siratul Uqala? If I want to put it in a way that, you know, you're going to be like, what the heck, you know, how could that be a proof for us? It's basically the conduct and what is common amongst the general public, Muslim, non-Muslim, everybody. Okay. Everybody's doing this, therefore it's allowed. What do we mean by everybody doing it and this, therefore it's allowed? Everybody mean, it's a commonly accepted, widely practiced concept that if you're not an expert, you refer to an expert. Okay. In medicine, we do this, every one of us. Some people become professionals in medicine, others don't. They have some other profession. When they're ill, they don't know how to cure themselves, they go to the expert. You got a car, you don't know how to fix it, you go to the expert. Your computer gets messed up, you don't know how to fix it, you go to the expert. Okay. Whatever happens that you don't have expertise in, or it's above and beyond your expertise, you refer to the expert. Okay, this is what is commonly practiced, it's acknowledged, and practiced. They say, because this is the case, we apply that to religion. Okay. In religion as well, in practical laws as well, I want to practice my religion. I don't know what those laws are. I'm not an expert. I refer to the expert. The expert tells me and I practice that. We apply the same concept here. Okay. Now here's where it becomes difficult and people will be, you know, trying to tear this apart. Like, what the heck, you're saying just because people do it and when they want to go and have their bodies cured, to have their illness cured, they go to a physician, a doctor, and you're applying that to religion? Because the kuffar do this? We have to listen to Imam al-Sadiq, we got to go and find some hadith. Even, I mean, this is how bad it becomes. This whole concept of akhbarism, unfortunately, is based on jahl, is based on very limited understanding, and condemning those who can understand more based on our limited capacity. That's what it's based on. Some people are of the opinion that even going to the doctor has got to be said by Imam al-Sadiq. Otherwise, you can't go to the doctor. This is what it comes down to. He needs to tell you everything. And tomorrow's discussion, I'll say it right now. Some people say, okay, we need something very clearly stated that you have got to refer during the time. These words have got to be said. During the time of the occultation, you have got to have a government, and that government has got to be led by a faqih. We have that? Acceptable. Present it to me. We don't have it? Forget it. Well, this is an ideology that exists. Okay. In regards to everything, they want to treat everything this way. This is not the case. Okay. How in the world can we take the practice of people in general and try to say that that is Islamic? Sometimes it's worded incorrectly. Sometimes people may say that, or may think that what we're doing is that because people do it, it should be accepted Islamically. That's not what is being said. How do we explain this? I'm going to try to take the least amount of time possible to explain this. It's an usuli concept, okay, which of course the Akhbaris hate, but nevertheless, you try to judge yourself, try to understand this. What are the sources for our religion? What are the sources that we try to understand what is wajib and what is haram? What are they? Can anybody help? Quran and Ahlul Bayt. What about the Prophet? Is that included in the Ahlul Bayt? Because sometimes when we say Ahlul Bayt, we mean other than the Prophet. I guess the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. Okay.
And logic?
Okay. What else? Is there anything else? What about Hadith? What about Ijma'? Have you guys heard that?
Yes.
We just talked about it in the first part of the session, right? Is Ijma' a source?
Yes.
It is?
Of the earlier scholars.
Man.
Yes. The Imam said, didn't you say the Imam said, follow?
My God, man. We should just end the session right here. I insisted that Ijma' in and of itself means nothing unless it gives us the Sunnah of the Ahlul Bayt. So that's not a source. It's just a way, a means of us telling what the Sunnah of the Ahlul Bayt and the Holy Prophet is. Okay. Right? So Ijma' is not a source in itself. It just leads us to source. What about Hadith?
Same
thing, right? Hadith isn't source. Hadith is this person saying the Imam said that. If we can come to the conclusion that the Imam actually said it, that's a source. If we don't come to the conclusion they can say all they want, that's not a source for it. The source is the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, along with the Holy Quran. This is revelation. This is what comes down to us that our intellect don't understand and guide us, and then we have an internal guidance called the intellect. The intellect doesn't really give us practical laws, okay? It's just the faculty for the most part, okay? For the most part. It's a faculty that gives us insight into understanding the verses of the Holy Quran and the Ahadith, okay? We need to use this faculty to understand them properly. If you want to put it aside, try to take things as face value, that's not going to work. Anyhow, the important thing, I want to focus on the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, and I want to give you the idea that we just tried to make clear. Hadith is not a source, okay, originally. It's just a means to get us to the source. The same way that Ijma' itself is not a source, okay, it's a means that helps us arrive at the source. That's what it's for. Now, what do we mean by the sunnah of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt? Let's understand this a bit, and then we'll get to this concept that we just talked about. What's the sunnah of the Holy Prophet? Obviously, something that is very clear to us is that if the Holy Prophet or the Ahlul Bayt tell us to do something, you need to do something, then we say, okay, sam'an wa ta'atan, we accept that, we are going to be obedient to that. Right? The Imam says, you pray at the time of Zawal, we just read it, say, okay, we will obey. That's a source, we get that. When we see the Imam saying, whether it's Dhahabul Humra or Istitharul Qurs, okay, the sunset or the Maghrib that you usually practice, whichever, we come to the conclusion, okay, through our research, the thought we put into it, we come to the conclusion, let's say, to Dhahabul Humra til Mashriqin. They've said these words, that is something we could. This part of the Sunnah is pretty clear. Another part of the Sunnah is also clear, okay, I think. Another part of the Sunnah is the conduct of the Imam. We just read a hadith. The hadith didn't even quote the Imam. Okay, it just said, we prayed. The Imam prayed Dhuhr and Asr. Okay, the Imam didn't say pray Dhuhr and Asr. There were other ahadith, but this one that we quoted. The Imam himself prayed Dhuhr and Asr. Another example of that. At the time of Maghrib, one question that people had, it was a serious discussion amongst even the ulama, was that is the time of Maghrib restricted or not? Do we have until midnight to do it? Or is it just the first hour or so after Maghrib time? Okay. Some were of the opinion that you can't delay it. We have hadith, very clear ones, the wording of it. It says, if you delay your Maghrib Salat until you can see the stars in the sky, you're mal'oon, you're cursed. We pray it at, God forbid, you know, a lot later than that. But anyway, he says, if you delay it to that much, you're mal'oon. Okay, so this became a dilemma. Okay, what do we do with that? We only have those first 15-20 minutes after Maghrib time, because if we agree that Dhahabul Humrat al-Mashriqiyya is the time for Maghrib, when that redness in the, what we consider Maghrib, which is basically 20 minutes after sunset, if that is Maghrib time, stars showing up is going to be maybe 10-15 minutes after that. Okay, so we need to quickly do it, otherwise we're mal'oon. Okay. This was a discussion. Now, companion says, we went to the presence of Imam al-Ridha, salamullah alayhi. We were sitting with him, the sun set, the redness in the eastern horizon was gone, the one in the western horizon was gone, all the light was gone until it was completely dark. Some stars showing, no, it was completely dark. That's when the Imam stood up and started praying. The conduct of the Imam is hujjah for us, that is the sunnah. Okay? We realize that it is allowed. Now what's the, how do we put those two together? That's a different topic, I don't want to spend time on that. It was a different, a deviant view that was doing that, doing something that the Imam was telling people they shouldn't be doing that. Anyway, the conduct of the ma'soom is also something that is hujjah, is part of the sunnah. Okay. Conduct, I mean things that are done, his own actions. He prayed a certain way. He performed wudu a certain way. He performed hajj a certain way. He performed prayer at a certain time. All these that are reported to us, this is the sunnah. Another thing that is the sunnah, okay, is based on the responsibility of the imam. If the imam sees people doing something that is wrong and incorrect religiously, what is his responsibility? Corrected. Okay. Amr bil ma'ruf wa nahi al munkar is where a person knows that something is wrong and they do it. You need to do amr bil ma'ruf. Amr is you order them. You're a little harsh on them. Okay, to an extent, of course. That's when a person knows something is haram and they go ahead and do it. You need to do nahi al munkar. They know it's wajib to pray. They know the time of salat has come. They know they need to do it. They don't do it. You do amr bil ma'ruf. Okay. But when the person doesn't know, that's called irshadul jahil. It's not amr bil ma'ruf. Now, for the imam, the responsibility of guiding the people is such, if you see people are deviating, they're doing something wrong, what are you supposed to do? Correct. Guide them, correct them, tell them that this is wrong. Okay. Therefore, if it's reported to us that this companion says, I saw this other companion praying at this time, and the imam was there, he didn't say anything against it. Okay. What do we take from that? That form of prayer is allowed. Because if it was wrong, the Imam would have said something. We see it twice. This companion prayed in that way. It's reported to us. Okay. So, all right, seems to be allowed. Maybe we have some doubts. We see a second companion in a different session, in a different city, doing the same thing, the Imam not saying anything against it. Okay. What do we do in that case? We say, okay, the Imam is considering this legitimate and it's okay. The concept of Siratul Uqala is this. This is called, first of all, let me give you a little bit of terminology. It's called Taqrir. We say fi'l, the action of the ma'sum. Qawl, fi'l, qawl, the words of the ma'sum. Fi'l, the action of the ma'sum. And taqrir of the ma'sum is hujjah. If I do something in the presence of the Imam doesn't tell me that's wrong, then I come to the conclusion that there's nothing wrong with it. Very clearly. Siratul Uqala is related to this. If we see there's a practice amongst Uqala, people in general, Muslim, non-Muslim, before there was even a religion called Islam, people are doing something. The Imams, the Ma'sumeen, the Ahlul Bayt do not speak up against it. That's going to be sufficient for us to say that this is legitimate. The principle of referring to experts is something that all people have done throughout history. And there's indications of people doing it during the time of the Ma'sumeen, in the presence of the Ma'sumeen. But even if they didn't do it there, because it's a common practice amongst people throughout the world, in order to guide the people, because the guidance that the Imams provide, the Holy Prophet provides, is not limited to a certain location. It's not only for this particular city or the other city. It's for all people in all times. If there is a practice that is going to cause the religion to deviate, okay, the Ma'sumeen have got to speak up against it. If they don't, people are deviated, it is going to be their responsibility, their fault. And the Imams are going to do their responsibility correctly. We take this, there's very clear examples of that the Imam spoke of. For example, Qiyas. When Qiyas started to be used with deriving the practical laws and understanding it, the Ahlul Bayt said this is completely wrong. We have very, very harsh statements against people who do Qiyas. La'an and all kinds of very harsh language used against Qiyas. Okay. Other methods that were used and introduced by people to derive practical laws that were incorrect, the Ahlul Bayt spoke up against them very, very strongly. In order that practice that was introduced not by the Shias didn't do that. It wasn't the Shias that were doing it. It was Ahlul Sunnah. The Ahlul Sunnah didn't listen to the Imam either. Abu Hanifa started Qiyas. Okay. Imam al-Sadiq, Imam al-Baqir, the later Imams, they all condemned this. Did that change their opinion about it? No, they don't consider the view of the Imam something that they want to follow. Okay. The Imam condemned that because if he wouldn't have, it would have led the Shias to gradually develop that and start implementing that. The Imam condemned it very, very strongly. If this referring to the expert is going to lead, not at the time of the Imams because we refer to the Imams, I'll just take that as an assumption, because the further, what I will go over briefly inshallah, I think I'm already over the time, briefly inshallah, is the ahadith, the indication that this was actually going on during the time of the Ma'sumin. But let's just neglect that right now. Let's just say it didn't happen. If this practice is there amongst people during the time of the Ma'sumin, let's just say there's no need for it. Okay. I go, I have a question. I don't know what the ruling is. I go directly to the Imam. He says, you do such and such. I say, okay. All right, there's no need for it. But then, during the time of the occultation, when the Imam is not available and trying to figure out which words of the Imam are actually said by the Imam, which words of the Imam are actually intended the way we understand them. Because that's difficult, a lot of people are going to shy away from it. They're going to need to refer to somebody. Imam is not available, they're going to be referring to the experts that they're going to... So they're going to be practicing it afterwards. If it's something that even later on may lead to the Muslims, the Shias practicing it, which very clearly we have, the Imams should speak up against it. Okay? So we don't look for a hadith saying taqleed is allowed, we look for a hadith saying it's wrong. If we don't find any indication telling us that it's wrong, we come to the conclusion that it's actually correct. Okay. Because it was a practice very commonly accepted amongst uqala, amongst people, and it would definitely, as we can see it has, lead the Shia, the people, to use this in religion. If it's wrong, all these people have been misled because the Ahlul Bayt didn't speak up against it. So they should have spoken up against it. If they don't speak up against it, that's proof itself. We don't need a hadith. The absence of hadith is proof here. Okay. The absence of hadith condemning it is going to be proof here. Now all this is neglecting the hadith that talk about the existence of it during the time of the Ma'sumin. Now I want to mention just a couple, okay, because of the shortage of time, just a couple of ahadith, inshallah, that the Ahlul Bayt have actually encouraged people to do that during the time of the presence of the Ma'sum. And forget about now, we don't even have access to the Ma'sum. Okay. During the time where people could have directly gone to the Imam and asked him in person, the Imam told them to refer to this other individual, or he told that individual to give answer to the people in regards to the practical laws. There's a series of hadith. Some of them, the wording is basically people asking. Okay, I found the particular one that I was looking for. There's some of them that the wording isn't as explicit. Okay, to me it's crystal clear, but some may dispute that. Okay, I'll read the ones that may be disputed by people, which is incorrect. But anyway, one of the Hadith, Ahmad ibn Ishaq asks Abul Hasan alayhi salatu was salam. Abul Hasan should be Imam al-Hadi salamullah alayhi, the 10th Imam, because his kunya is also Abul Hasan because of the companion that is talked about in this hadith. He says, Sa'altuhu, Ahmad ibn Ishaq says, Sa'altuhu wa qult, man u'amil wa amman akhudh wa qawli man aqbal. Whose words should I accept? Whose words can I rely on? Okay. فقال العمري ثقتي فما أؤدي عني excuse me فما أدى إليك عني فعني يؤدي وما قال لك عني فعني يقول واسمع له وأطع فإنه الثقة المأمون. The person says, who do I ask my questions from? In different topics. Okay. The Imam says, you can refer to Amri. Amri is the first one of the Nawab of the Imam of our time. He was Wakil of the 10th Imam, Wakil of the 11th Imam, and he became the Naib, the first Naib of our 12th Imam. And I was told, at least, the scholar that was in Medina who passed away recently was basically the alim who supported, was what people found their support in, the person who they found their support in Medina, in that region, which is very difficult for the Shias. I forget his first name. Does anybody remember his name? That part I knew. That's the Amri part is actually, that's what I have from here. But the first part of his name I was trying to look for. Okay. Anyway, he's known as Sheikh Amri. Okay. Amri, it's the same Amri. They say he's the descendant of this individual who was the Naib. Now, I don't know how true that is, but that was a great alim that passed away, inshallah. Allah bless his soul, inshallah. Anyway, he says, the Imam tells him, Amri is my fiqh, he's reliable. Whatever he tells you from me, he is, you know, it's definitely from me. Listen to that and obey that. Okay. Let me read a couple more, and then I'll raise an objection with this using this hadith for the purpose that we are, and then I'll try to answer that, inshallah. Second hadith, Hasan ibn Ali ibn Yaqtin, the son of the famous Ali ibn Yaqtin, says, and there's others as well, they ask, عن الرضا عليه الصلاة والسلام. قال قلت لا أكاد أصل إليك أسألك عن كل ما أحتاج إليك من معالم ديني. أَفَ يُونُسُ بْنُ عَبْدِ الرَّحْمَانِ ثِقَةٌ أَخُذُ عَنْهُمَا أَحْتَاجُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ مَعَالِمِ دِينِي فَقَالْ نَعَمْ. Since we asked him, all of us, we sometimes can't come to you. Now at the time of the Imam, it was just a matter of making their way to Medina or to Marwah, depending on the timing of it, and asking the question. Okay. At this time, we just have no access at all, right, to the Imam of our time. So anyway, I'm just trying to give that extra emphasis that if this is said during that time, then for our time, it's definitely the case. So who do we go to, and what we need, what we require from ma'alimu dinina, for the knowledge of our religion that we require, is this person called Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, one of the greatest companions that we've had. Is he a reliable person? Not reliable in the hadithi sense that he doesn't lie. He's reliable means like he's a person that is someone that I can take the knowledge of my religion from. You know, I rely on him, which is basically the whole concept of taqreed itself too. Anyway, can I take it from him? The Imam says yes. So in other words, the mindset of this companion or these companions that are asking the question, there's no question that they can refer to and they need to refer to somebody. The question is Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman a reliable person? Or not? Okay. The Imam says yes, this is a reliable person. There's other ones that are mentioned as well. There may be an objection put forth in regards to this. I'll mention it briefly with a brief response to it. And that is, it could be said, okay, the Imam didn't say for them to do ijtihad. The Imam said for them to quote whatever they quote from me, then that is acceptable, okay? Ijtihad isn't that. Now, first of all, the first response to that, if you can, that was one of the reasons why I went over the topic of ijtihad so extensively. What is the process of ijtihad? Is that coming up with an opinion? Is that making up an opinion? Or is it quoting an opinion? It's just that amongst all of the things that are reported from the Ahlul Bayt, we try to make sense of it and say, this is what the Ahlul Bayt have said. It's nothing other than quoting. It just takes a process to come to the conclusion what the Ahlul Bayt have said. We're a little confused here with the wordings that we've received in hadith books. Other than that, it's the same thing. That's the first response that I have to say. The second response, if you remember, I said that this whole concept of akhbarism is based on jahl and ignorance. Okay, there is no one in this world that can live without taqlid. Even the so-called akhbaris are doing taqlid. How is that? The ahadith that we have, oh, this is going to be a little difficult for at least some of us to swallow. The ahadith that we have, much of them are actually not the wording of the Ahlul Bayt. Okay. When you hear me talking here, you want to quote something that I say, do you quote me word for word? You don't have any, especially back, they didn't have any recording device. Now, unfortunately, you have. You can quote me and say, you said this and get me for it. Okay. But they didn't have recording devices then. Yeah, some people had good memories, but it was remembering what is said, the message that is given. Sometimes the wording would change. A change in wording has led to a difference in conflict of the hadith. It could be ta'aruf because of that. Okay. The other thing, so I want to expand on this dimension of the wording of the hadith not being that of the ma'sum. Dealing with that, what the response, how do we still take that? That's something that needs to be answered. But nevertheless, we're still using the understanding of that companion of the words of the ma'sum. The same way that a mujtahid is giving you their understanding of what the words of the ma'sum are. On top of that, I'll give you one example that the companions, the ones who compiled hadith books, picked and chose hadith. They didn't just give you whatever hadith came to them. Refer to the introduction of Kitab al-Kafi, refer to the introduction of Man la yahdhuruhu al-faqih, refer to the introduction of Kamilu Ziyarat, refer to the introductions of all these books. They tell you for a fact, they say, look, there's a lot of hadith out there. I'm giving you what I think is reliable. So there's hadith there that are not considered reliable by this person. There's a set of hadith that talk about one thing, give one view about our practices. There's a set that talk about it in a different way. Some of these books quote one set and not the other, because according to their view, this is what the practice is. The other ahadith are actually not said by the ma'sum. They're already doing that for you. Just because you received a set of words of the Ahlul Bayt that are quoted, that doesn't mean you're not doing taqlid. The other thing is, how do you even know the Imam has said it? Shaykh al-Sadduq has compiled this book in the fourth century, the third century, Kulayni has compiled the book at the end of the second and the beginning of the third century. He didn't see the Ma'sumin, or if he saw Imam al-Askari briefly. The hadith he quotes are from Imam al-Sadiq. How do you know for a fact that he actually, or the Imam actually said this? He goes through the chain of narrators, he looks at the message, and he says, according to my understanding, this person is reliable, all these people are reliable, this message is appropriate, this is what the Imam has said. You're doing taqlid. It's just not the most efficient and accurate way of doing it. That's the difference. Okay. Everybody is doing taqlid during this time. Whether you call yourself akhbari or usuli, you're all doing taqlid. No one's doing anything other than that. It's just that the so-called usuli, I don't even like these names, okay? The mainstream Shias, okay, are doing efficient and accurate taqlid, and those who call themselves akhbaris are doing inefficient taqlid. They're just picking and choosing things that are said in مَنْ لَا يَحْضُرُهُ الْفَقِيهُ or in Al-Kafi and these things and saying this is what the Imam said without looking at all the other ones. Look, for those who are interested in this, look at a hadith in the chapter of Kitab al-Fadl al-Ilm of Al-Kafi, which inshallah the akhbaris accept the ahadith in Al-Kafi at least. The first hadith, I think, in one of those chapters is from Kitab Sulaym ibn Qais al-Hilali. And it's a very important hadith about the differences that have that exist in hadith. Of course, that's one of the earlier hadith because it's quoting Amir al-Mu'mineen on it in the differences of the narrations and the reports from the Holy Prophet. One important thing that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says in that hadith, okay? He says the same way that the verses of the Holy Quran have muhkam and mutashabih, the sayings of the Ahlul Bayt have the sayings of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt have muhkam and mutashabih. You can't just take it and say this is what the hadith means and this is what we need to do. There's muhkam and mutashabih. You need to interpret the mutashabih based on the muhkam. Okay. There's nasikh and mansukh. This is the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Some of the ahadith were said, then later on the Holy Prophet said, don't do that any longer, do it in this way. And it's not the verses of the Holy Quran. It says the hadith has nasikh and mansukh. Okay. One view about khums is actually that. I can't expand on it right now because of the shortage of time. But anyway, I'm just referring to this. We have hadith very clearly. Even the ahadith have this muhkam and mutashabih. All of that, it's not an easy type. The most efficient way of doing taqlid is going to the mujtahideen who are experts in it, that are alive, that can tell us what they mean, instead of referring to someone that lived way back when, that we make very easily misunderstand their words and the conclusion that they've reached at. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to increase our insight and our understanding of the religion, and also that He helps us and enables us to put that in practice, inshallah. Recite a salawat and start with questions. It's a good question. Of course, I don't recall in this particular lecture, in other lectures I have, but I don't recall in this particular lecture talking about lecturers. But that is a valid point that I have raised in other areas, that we need to be careful where we get our knowledge of the religion. The same way that in fiqh we can't do that, we can't do it for aqa'id as well, we can't do it about history as well, we can't do it for akhlaq either. And you know, it's the same concept, trying to get the most accurate opinion about the religion. We need to be careful. Now, some of the speakers are pious, they consider themselves people that haven't studied, they go and refer to the scholars, learn that, come present the material that is given from a scholar. Sometimes, unfortunately, people go beyond their limits without having the expertise. They start throwing out opinions, quoting hadith, and they haven't had the training to be able to go through hadith and verses of the Holy Quran in order to give us what the hadith truly means. So we have this problem, and we need to be careful with that. This is not to say, sometimes people go on extremes, they don't want to listen to anybody, and everybody, you know, they need some approval from the Hauser or something, written statement from some marja or something, for it to be allowed to listen to someone. That's also a little bit extreme. What we hear, okay, if it's something we've heard for the first time, we got to check it with someone that we know that has the full training that we can refer to. Otherwise, if it's things that we've already heard from reliable sources, it's a good reminder, because a lot of times we need reminders as well. Okay, so reminders are okay. If it's something new we haven't heard of, especially if it sounds awkward, go and check. Sometimes I'm kind of shocked, because people tell me about some speaker saying something, and they didn't find it weird and awkward. Okay. And because of that, they didn't ask anybody else. And I kind of wonder, like for example, this idea of amongst men and women in Islam and the opposite genders, there is no idea of trying to be segregated. It's okay, you know, mixing is okay. As long as you don't joke around too much and you have that hijab on, you can, you know, be sitting around giggling, chit-chat and all of that. Just don't joke around too much. Have an organic relationship. I heard that, and where the heck did that come from? Okay, it's not what Islam says. Islam encourages, not necessarily wajib, some of the encouragement, but it's definitely encouraged to try to keep segregated. Don't, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I don't say salam to younger women. What does that tell you? Okay. And other things. Anyhow, sometimes we need to be a little more careful when we hear something that we haven't heard of before. We should go and try to check with someone that is a little more learned to make sure we're not getting misinformation. But back to your question, actually. Okay, how do we figure out if a person has a formal, thorough training or not? Well, I should tell you, the first few years in the Hawza, we tell the students, don't go out lecturing, don't answer questions. If you want to have very, very simple classes using the books that you've been taught, not going beyond that, limited number of people, so you don't start feeling it in your head and you want to have bigger sessions and answering questions, those limited sessions, go ahead and teach like aqaid or ahkam, things that you've learned with the book. But otherwise, you can't start lecturing just yet. Okay. First few years in the Hawza doesn't really give us too much, especially if we're doing thorough studies, which first couple of years just give us Arabic grammar and a little bit of logic, a little bit of maybe usul, a little bit of fiqh. It's not much at all. We can't really come to conclusion. So the first few years, it's not really going to be much to say that this person has got, you know, proper training. There should be at least, well, I'll give the book because sometimes people do it quicker, sometimes people do it a little slower. Traditionally, the Hawza takes about 7-8 years to get, you know, a little bit of maqasib done. So, you know, the aqaid is a little more solid. They do a little bit of philosophy at that point. Their fiqh is more solid. Their understanding of history is more solid. They do maqasib around that time, the first seven, 8 years. Sometimes people are able to manage and get that done a little quicker. Basically, if a person has done lum'a and maqasib, or started maqasib, 1 year of maqasib, with the philosophy that is given, the aqaid that is given, if they've studied thoroughly, that should be enough to start lecturing, giving you know, understandings. Of course, they also need to be careful. All of us need to be careful. The maraja are careful, the ulama are careful. But you know, that's a training where they can start developing understandings and present lectures in a way where we can kind of rely on their opinion to an extent, unless it's, you know, completely wayward and you know, something we can't really swallow, then we should ask someone that is even more knowledgeable than them. We tried to address that issue last year, or last time I was, we had the fiqh classes. I think it's in the recordings. Briefly, I want to say just a couple of words regarding it. That's very true. The criterion that the maraja mention, almost all of them, at least most of them, there's a list of qualifications, including being the most knowledgeable. Okay, how can we figure it out with all the different views that are out there, and somebody says this one is more knowledgeable, the other person says somebody else is more knowledgeable, and so on and so forth. One thing that, if it depends on our conclusion, sometimes that conclusion could make life very difficult on us. If we truly are of the opinion that one of these people, two, three, four names that I've heard, if I come to the conclusion one of them is more knowledgeable than the rest and more knowledgeable than everybody else, but I can't figure out which one of the four it is, that's going to make life very difficult, because we're going to have to do ihtiyat. Okay, trying to learn all of their fatawa, wherever they're different, we got to do ihtiyat. Sometimes we're going to have to do our prayers two times, sometimes maybe even three times, depending on the fatawa that exists. So that's going to be a very difficult one. If we reach that conclusion, we got to do a lot more research so that we can be confident that to reach one of the other conclusions that I'm about to mention. So if that conclusion is not a good one, makes life difficult. Okay, if we reach a conclusion that these two, three, or four names that I've been given, amongst them, it seems like, because of this whole difference of opinion, it seems like they're pretty close in rank, and that's why people can't figure out which one is more knowledgeable than the other. If we reach that conclusion, it's easier to deal with, okay? Because then we can refer to one of their fatwas. Some of these maraja, many actually have this view, that if you have people that are equal or not known to be more knowledgeable than others, there's two or three that are known to be knowledgeable than the rest, but amongst themselves it's not clear if one is more knowledgeable than the others, then you can, some of the fatawa are, you can choose between them. Okay, if you reach this conclusion that I know these two, three, or four people are more knowledgeable than the rest, but I don't know if any of them is more knowledgeable than the other, it seems like they're pretty much at the same level of knowledge, the procedure would be check their fatwa on this issue, see if they allow you to choose. Usually you'll find at least one of them to have that view. If they have it, then that makes life easy. You just choose amongst them and go on with it. If you don't find any amongst them that has this view, then life becomes, again, difficult. You should do more research until you personally feel, with all the research, all these people that you've listened to, you've heard, and they've explained their view, you come to the conclusion, it seems like more people agree on this particular manager being most knowledgeable, okay? Then you should try to reach that conclusion and go with that. And I know it's not easy. I know it's definitely difficult, but this is the procedure we need to take.
Okay, if I can try to cap that question.
I'll word it in my words with your permission. Okay. Okay, basically, if we don't go to the Hawza, can we become spiritual, or there's no other way? And if we can't make it there, then we're just, in your words, doomed. It's not required to go to the Hawza to obtain spirituality, okay. There are definitely certain levels that can be acquired by just practicing things that we're all familiar with. Our problem really is putting things that we already know into practice, okay. That's what we all have an issue with. It's not about knowing what's more and what's beyond that. Our problem is practicing what we already know. No, okay. If we practice all of that, if we avoid all the sins which every risala has, I think at least some of you guys have heard this many times from me. One of the urafa that's still alive, they ask him, what's the best irfan book? He says, the risala of your marja. Okay, go and read that, practice it. Just by staying away from all the sins and performing all the obligations, there's so much spirituality that will be given to us that is beyond our head. Okay, once we do that, then we can start thinking about what's beyond that. All right. For what's beyond that, for people, you know, people need some form of trainer to get to, and it's very difficult to find, even in the cities of the houses, it's very difficult to find such people. But we're not doomed, so just do what you have. Do what you have to do. Well, let me repeat the question so then we can answer it and people can hear it too. The question is about basically treating the, how we should treat and deal with the hadith books, or I will add the translation of the Holy Quran, same concept. Of course, different, because hadith, we have also amongst the hadith sayings that are not even said by the ma'soom. But in the case of the Holy Quran, obviously all of it is actually from the divine. So there's a difference there, but there are some books that have more reliable hadith in them. We can kind of rely on the majority of the hadith that are in those books. We do have such books. But more importantly, the interpretation and understanding of these hadith and verses. In this session, okay, so what are we supposed to do with them? How should we treat them? What should we do with the translations? Should we pick them up and read them? Should we come to conclusions? Should we just refer to the ulama in regards to them? Ideally, okay, what the tradition of the ulama was, the tradition of the companions was that ahadith were given to people not just through books, they were read to them and explained to them. Ideally, if you have someone that can do that, that is qualified, that can explain hadith for us, then we should try to do that, okay? But unfortunately, For most cities in the West, there aren't people, or the people are busy, they're not available for us to have time with, and so on and so forth. So what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to avoid it? Is that the message that we're trying to give? The message we try to give is that you can't come to definite conclusions about especially the details of the religion, okay? Certain things, I think there's no doubt, it's very straightforward. Is salat wajib or not? Verse says salat is wajib. You know, I don't need anybody to come and tell me salat is wajib. Okay. But what does hafidhu ala salawati wa salat al-wusta mean exactly? Okay. Somebody interprets it in one way. You find a hadith that says it another way. It's not wrong to read that. It's not wrong to think about that. But to come to definite conclusions, to the extent especially to be able to argue with people that have had thorough training, you know, it really doesn't make sense. Okay, we're not told that we can't read the verses of the Holy Quran and understand from them. Okay, so we should try to do that to our limit, but we should be humble about it. Okay, we should know that our knowledge of this is very limited. My knowledge of the Quran is the translation of the Quran. It could be wrong. If some scholar comes and says this translation is wrong, say, okay, I don't know. He's done the training. Maybe some other scholar is going to say something else. I'm referring to the translation of the Quran. I'm referring to the translation of the Hadith. There could be a problem with that. Okay. The other thing is, I have access to only these verses or this limited collection of Hadith. I haven't seen all of it. Okay. Plus, I haven't studied the background of it. I haven't studied the history of it. So my understanding, I try to understand it, but it could be wrong. Okay. If I have access to someone, I'll ask them. If someone tells me that I was wrong, I'm willing to take that in. The problem that arises when people start, you know, they become very comfortable with reading all of that, is that they become very comfortable with their own understandings and they think that that is it. You know, that's the best conclusion you can come up to. It's all logical, it makes sense. They bring 51 reasons for it as well. Okay, that's what I'm trying to warn people about. It's not easy to come to conclusions. You know, we've got to know the background of Hadith and all the rest of what we explained in this session. Okay, let me try to summarize that question. It's basically about questions that are sent to the offices of Maraja. Generally speaking, the office of Maraj, I can generalize, I think, with my knowledge of the offices. So when the question is sent, well, in addition to what you said, a lot of times there's delays, people don't even get responses sometimes. Mostly. Well, I don't know about most of the time, I hope it's not most of the time, but they don't get responses too quickly. Sometimes they don't get responses at all. When the response comes, then here's the real question, like the brother asked, that we really don't know who answered that. We may have doubts. Okay, we'd like to know who answered that, how accurate that is. Also, was the translation of my question put forth correctly or not? And then when they gave the response to that, was that response translated correctly or not? And then when we ask for resources to look at, that's not provided to us. One thing that I need to again add is, or just give you the information of, the office of Maraja don't answer any question other than strictly fiqh, the view of this Marja. They don't answer anything other than that, okay? So they're not going to tell you what hadith there is, they're not going to answer any aqaid question you have, they're not going to answer any of that. Some of them have set up sites for that purpose, but the ones that are considered the office, like Sistani.org, the examples that you mentioned, Sistani.org for Ayatollah Sistani, and Leader.ir for Ayatollah Khamenei, these sites strictly answer questions related to fiqh in the view of that marja that they are representing. So they're not going to answer anything beyond that. You have political questions, they won't answer. You have aqad questions, they won't answer. Akhlaq, they won't answer. Nothing except specifically about the practical laws and the view of the marja that you are asking. There are concerns that exist with the way the offices of Maraja respond to questions. We have relayed these concerns. We've spoken to the different people that are involved there. All I can say is that I acknowledge that. Okay. I don't have too much of a solution that I can give for it. Okay. All I can say is for people that that is their only means of communication. That is the hujjah on them. They can't get any more than that. The same way that we know that all the differences of opinion that the ulama have, all of them aren't correct. We know one view is what Islam says. Okay. The rest of it is just something that we've done our responsibility. We can't do any more than that. Okay. Now, if English is the only language I understand, and I don't know anyone that knows the fatawa of this marja from the Arabic sources directly that I can trust, my only source is the site to refer to. Even if I have doubts, that's the resources that I have available to me. If I act in accordance to that, even if that's not even the view of the marja, then I did my share. Okay. So that is going to be hujjah. I'm emphasizing on this. That is hujjah on them. If people have doubts, if they find someone that they know that is to them more reliable with proof, of course, you know, sometimes we consider maybe some people that are more reliable and it's not the case. We know their background, we know how they know the fatawa of this particular marja. We've tested them with many questions and checked that with other sources, other resources that we've had, and we realized that usually this person has got more accurate answers than a lot of others. We can check it with them and see if they can help us out on it. But otherwise, if we don't have access to such a person, then that's basically the fatwa that is at our disposal, and that's what we can use and act upon. Yes, are the ones that are scanned in English?
They're scanned in Arabic. Or
well, that's the thing.
See, there's a translation.
Yeah, the translation is probably... No, does the translation have a stamp as well?
Yeah, some of them.
Some of them, because the thing is, there's a couple of issues there. First of all, the collection of fatawa that they have in Arabic and in Farsi is more than English. Okay, that's one thing. The other thing that happens is that them updating the English is usually happens latest. Okay, they update the Farsi and the Arabic. Okay, sometimes Arabic first, sometimes Farsi first, depending on the office and who's involved there. They update that first, and then later on, sometimes much later on, unfortunately, the English gets updated. So for those two reasons, okay, it's more difficult to find those fatawa online, okay, on the office of that marja. That also exists, and you know, as I said, I really can't say anything in regards to it because I don't represent anybody. I just can say I've seen that, I've acknowledged that, and we've spoken to people that we know of to try to help the situation, and you know, what's out there is what it is, basically. Yeah, because I wasn't, you know, I'm not trying to present a faqih opinion and say that, okay, this is right or the other one's right. That's one of the questions that was asked between the time. Let me repeat the question that the sister mentioned. Keep your second question too. I'll answer this one and then we'll get to the second one, inshallah. Question is raised that, okay, we talked about how Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khoui, and some of the others believe that Ahlul Kitab are najis, whereas Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Khamenei, some of the other more recent ones believe that they are tahir. We explained why, or their view, that how they consider them najis. We didn't explain how they are considered tahir. There's different explanations that are given. What we tried to give was how the principle we're trying to explain, and everybody agrees with the principle. They may not agree with this being an example or an application of a proper application of that principle, but everybody agrees with the principle, and the principle is actually what we tried to explain. The principle is, sometimes you may even have hadith on something, okay, but due to other reasons, we would come to the conclusion that that hadith is either not said, or if it is said, it is not the actual view of the ma'sum. That was the principle we were trying to give. That makes referring to hadith even more difficult. Okay. Now, in regards to the actual fatwa, the ijma' that Imam Khomeini narrates and Sayyid Khoui gives his ihtiyat wajib because of that ijma', some of the recent ulama disagree with that ijma'. They say that there isn't really such an ijma'. Okay. With explanation. In order to explain that, we would have to bring the wordings of the previous ulama and see what the understanding of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khoui was from them, that they conclude that there is an ijma' on the issue. And Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei say, no, there isn't an ijma' on the issue. Once we put aside that ijma', we don't find any sufficient proof that says that they are najis. Actually, we find a hadith, as we mentioned, that say that they are tahir. So it's all about accepting that ijma or not accepting it. If I want to quickly try to recap that, you know, how do we treat situations where we want to speak out, whether it's towards our brothers and sisters of faith, and they're doing something wrong, we want to do amr bil ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar, or it's with the general public maybe, or even maybe with some Muslims, that they, you know, it's about political views or individuals like Imam Khomeini, countries like Palestine, and so on and so forth. How do we approach these issues in a way where, you know, we don't seem like we're opposing everybody, and you know, we wrong everybody else, and we think we're the only one that's doing things right? The answer to the first part, the amr ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar, towards brothers and sisters of faith. First of all, we are only responsible to our ability, what we have been considered responsible for. We have plenty of ahadith that tell us, the ma'sumeen have been asked, that if we tell our family members, for example, to do something that's wajib on them, or we told them to refrain from something that is haram, and we told them a few times, they're not listening, is it okay if we stop telling them? The ma'sum said, yes. Your responsibility was to tell them. If they don't want to listen, you don't have any sin. You did your responsibility. You did your share. Okay. So you don't need to constantly repeat that. Say it a few times, they don't want to listen, just forget them. They want to go to hell, let them do it. We told them. Seriously. That's just. Anyway, it's their problem. They're not listening. It's their problem. In regards to more social political issues, I would also, in this case as well, I would say, we've got to be wise when we speak. Okay, it shouldn't be like every time we hear something that is different than what we see and the clear truth that we see, for example, the goodness of Imam Khomeini, the goodness of the revolution, the goodness of speaking out against the oppressions and the atrocities in the occupied lands and other regions of the world. If we see someone speaking against that even passionately, it shouldn't be like we automatically feel like we need to say something and, you know, get real hot about it and start arguing. And it's not the case. Okay, we've got to be wise about it. Sometimes if we speak up, instead of actually causing others to agree with us, it's going to cause them to distance themselves from this truth. Okay, we've got to be wise. We've got to make the right choices when to speak. Okay. And how to speak. I don't think I can say, okay, if you say it in this particular way, it's always going to work. No, it's dealing with people. In dealing with people, we need to start to, you know, through trial and error, through speaking to people about particular cases, not junk, particular cases, you know, this is what I did, or this is what they're doing, how should we treat it, and so on and so forth. We learn the techniques of how to deal with different circumstances. So we got to be wise about when we speak and wise about how we say those words. There's a lot of details to that, and I think that needs to be addressed on case by case.